So you do have these laws, and presumably with these laws you would see an increase in environmental litigation. Is that what your studies have shown? Has there been an increase in citizen litigation of environmental claims in China? And what is like the status of that litigation?
Yeah, I wish we had better data on that. That would be really nice if you were writing a book on environmental litigation in China. All research is limited by the statistics that the Chinese government chooses to release. And the data on the numbers of environmental lawsuits have been really piecemeal. So the best data I have is from a Supreme People's Court work report, 2011. They announced that there were about 12,000 civil lawsuits the year before, so that would be 2010. Mm-hmm. And the volume of litigation going through the legal system in general is about 4.1 million civil cases a year. So we've got a tiny fraction.
So it's very small.
Yeah, it's very small, but that would be true in all legal systems. Okay. You know, environmental lawsuits are always a pretty small portion of what's going. Most civil cases.
So,
courts
like in the
are busy.
United States, do you know like what percent or?
Yeah, I don't know about. I don't know the exact percent, but the numbers would be roughly comparable. Courts are mostly busy handling dispute, you know, divorce, family matters, you know, the kind of stuff that is much more every day.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure the numbers of environmental lawsuits have been rising because there is clear data that the numbers of environmental disputes have been rising.
Okay.
So if disputes are going up, my expectation is that lawsuits are going up as well.
And in terms of these lawsuits, I guess for like, you know, keep in mind that a lot of people who read this blog are American students of law or students of American law. I guess what do these cases look like? I mean, are they largely angry citizens bringing these suits on their own, pro se? What role do nonprofits play? Like, is there a Sierra Club or an NRDC in China? And how do these cases play out in the courts in China?
So most of the cases are what lawyers call tort cases.
Right.
The cases that I'm looking at, which are civil cases.
Right, and a tort case is like basically a case where somebody's been injured.
Yeah, exactly. So they involve monetary compensation for damages.
Right.
The archetypal case that I always think about is there's a chemical factory upstream, and there's a guy farming fish downstream, and there's a chemical spill at the chemical factory, and the fish farmer wakes up and all of his fish are dead, and he wants 10,000 renminbi from the chemical factory to pay for the dead fish.
Right.
So that's where like the average case is in the Chinese legal system. It's not about environmental rights per se. It's about money.
It's about monetary damage.
It's about monetary damages, and it's not necessarily about health. When I was doing this, when I was writing this book in the end of the first decade of the 2000s, lawyers were trying to get money for health claims for pollution victims, and that was very much on the frontier.
Okay.
That was, if you could get money for a cancer victim and link that case to pollution, that was a huge victory. That was not the mainstream case that was going through the legal system at all.
And is that more of a result of like evidence issues to show that the... Because, I mean, I know even in the United States, like you see Aaron Brockovich, which you mentioned in your book, which I thought was funny, you know, proving that people's cancer is a result of a certain chemical is hard even in the United States. Is that hard to show even more in China, where presumably you wouldn't have the resources because lawyers aren't paid maybe in the same way?
Yeah, I think there's two things going on. I think the issue you're talking about is causation, which is really hard. I mean, this is so hard in all environmental lawsuits. It doesn't matter if they're happening in China or Zambia or New Jersey. Mm-hmm. That link is always super hard. And it's really hard for Chinese judges to figure it out. I mean, here in the U.S., we would have competing experts dueling it out over what the groundwater patterns show. And in China, what they tend to do is they tend to outsource this issue of causation to an appraisal agency. So judge's impulse is usually to find a neutral third party to write something up. And one of the big issues that comes out of that came out of my field work was that the quality of these appraisals is all over the place. Sometimes they're done really conscientiously by people with a really strong background in environmental science, and they're really good. And sometimes they're really awful and done by people who have no idea what they're talking about.
Yeah.
And there's not a lot of quality control.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, that's the critical piece of evidence when it exists in these cases. And one of the steps forward for it, for Chinese environmental litigation to work better, is you have to control the quality of these appraisals better than has been done in the past.
And in terms of environmental cases getting into the court system, because I know a lot of people talk about how the courts don't have to take a case.
No, they sure don't.
How successful are environmental cases in making it past that first hurdle?
It's really hard.
Yeah.
I think that's actually the biggest stumbling block.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's getting the case into court and convincing judges, the judges at the case acceptance division of the court, that this is a good way to handle the dispute.
Mm-hmm.
That's the moment in which the case is likely to be turned away. The best data I have suggests that if you get your case accepted by the court as a plaintiff in one of these environmental lawsuits, plaintiffs will get something. Not everything they want. Maybe it's just one renminbi, but they'll get something 50% of the time. So the big stumbling block is getting it in the door and convincing judges that this is a case that they can deal with. That's within the court's jurisdiction and realm of possibility.
Right. And in terms of, I mean, do you ever see, like, you have the monetary relief,
yeah,
so you have to show damages for that guy whose fish are all
right.
dead because of chemicals in the water. Do you ever see cases where they ask for injunctive relief, where they ask for the industry to stop polluting, to shut down the industry, or anything like that?
Yeah, so a very typical sentence in an environmental decision will call on the polluter to stop harm.
Okay.
It's not an injunction, but that's usually part of the decision. The problem, of course, is enforcement. I mean, it's very rare for the courts to follow up make sure that the decision is actually enforced. So one of the more exciting things that's been happening is that some of the environmental courts have been working with the Environmental Protection Bureau to establish monitoring of decisions after the fact to make sure that there's a cleanup plan and that it actually happens.
Okay.
But again, that's really the frontier.
That's still the frontier,
That's the frontier of where we hope environmental law is going, as opposed to the mainstream of where it is right this second.
I mean, I guess, like, given all of that, I mean, do you think there are, like, successful environmental cases in China? I mean, you had talked in one of your chapters in the book about the Pingnan case, where the villagers won on the law, right?
Yeah.
Like, they ostensibly won. The company had to clean up the pollution and pay a fine. But ultimately, the fine amounted to such a small amount of money,
$63. Isn't that a depressing story?
It was very depressing.
Especially because this was, like, the most celebrated environmental lawsuit of 2006.
Right.
So this was, like, trumpeted as a major victory, and then the glass is half empty, right?
You know,
it's not that much.
I mean, in your mind, and I guess in some of the people that are on the forefront of the environmental movement in China, some of the lawyers and the judges in the environmental courts and the government agencies that deal with it, I mean, how do they define victory? Do they really see this as a victory? Do they understand that it's not?
They would
really
definitely see Pingnan as a victory.
Okay.
Not so much because of what the villagers got, but because of the media attention that story got and the way in which it called attention to the issue and the way in which it reframed the debate.
Mm-hmm.
So the media attention itself is a victory, regardless of what people actually get, because it's questioning the articles that came out of the Pingnan lawsuit are questioning the old economic growth at all costs model that China has been on for so long.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So insofar as that the real story is about raising environmental consciousness and creating the groundwork for an environmental movement, any lawsuit that gets national attention is a success. But it's hard to know. I mean, you know, I would sometimes, in my interviews, I would ask lawyers, can you tell me about a successful lawsuit? And they come back with a story of, you know, the punchline of the successful lawsuit for them is often the factory closed up and moved away. And so my next question is, where did it go? And the answer is often, you know, it went to this poorer part of the province.
Right.
So is that a real victory? You know, it is for the people who live in that place, but it raises real concerns about environmental justice and you know, whether or not these lawsuits, are, you know, if you take the nation mm-hmm. as the unit of analysis, whether or not they're really doing that much to improve environmental quality.
Right.
So this is such a tough field.
Yeah.
You know?
No.
It's the kind of, you have to celebrate every little success, even if it doesn't add up to, you know, success on the level of Brown versus the Board of Education.
Right.
Or a case that's
that
big.
I mean, when that came down, wasn't enforced in a lot of places. It was just enforced in that one, and then the Supreme Court decided to wait to integrate. So, I mean, I guess it is kind of fair to see Ping Nan as a victim, because it did get media attention and did raise rights consciousness, but then it was a little bit of money for the people that were harmed.
I know. You know, and I find that, again, just speaking in general, the plaintiffs tend to be pretty happy if they get any part of what they wanted.
Right.
They really feel like the deck is stacked against them.
Yeah.
In these type of cases. And if they get a fair hearing, and if they get a portion of what they wanted, they tend to think that that's a success.
Yeah. I mean, what do you think, like, right now, are the roadblocks to what we would define as success, where the plaintiff is made more whole than they are being made right now?
Yeah.
What are the major roadblocks that you're seeing in environmental litigation in China?
Well, we already mentioned two of the really big ones. One is getting the case into court and convincing judges that this is part of their responsibility, is to hear these kinds of cases, and improving the quality of appraisals so that they have a real scientific basis and judges can really rely on them.
Right.
I think that those two reforms would go a long way towards improving the quality of justice in these kinds of cases. The third one is enforcement of decisions. So putting teeth in the idea that you have to clean up after a decision, as opposed to basically pay off plaintiffs with a little bit of money. It would be the third thing. And I think for that really to work, there needs to be cooperation between the court and the Environmental Protection Bureau to a much deeper degree.
So right now, I mean, what are you seeing right now between the court and the Environmental Protection Bureau? So
usually nothing.
So in China, is it that when the court orders, you know, for the plant to stop polluting the water, is it then the responsibility of the local Environmental Protection Bureau to enforce that, or
right now it's kind of no one's responsibility?
Oh, okay. That
it's kind of in a gray zone where nobody's going to be held to task for it. Mm-hmm. Nobody's going to follow up. Everybody knows that. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, you know, you can imagine a situation. I mean, one of the criticisms of China sometimes is there's not enough judicial independence.
Right.
The courts are too likely to communicate with other branches of government. But the flip side is you could really take advantage of that.
Yeah.
If the courts were communicating with the EPB and making this cleanup part of the EPB's mandate, that could really make a big difference. Of course, the problem is that environmental protection bureaus are chronically underfunded and understaffed, so that problem needs to be addressed.
Yeah.
But at least the possibility is there.
You know, like when I was reading your book, and I mean, definitely these are problems in environmental litigation in China, but I mean, honestly, like a lot of this seems to be problems in a lot of like citizen rights cases, you know, disability rights, things like that. I mean, do you think this is also a problem in other fields?
Oh, totally. Totally. All of these, I mean, some of it's a little bit specific, like the issue with the appraisals,
that's a little
special, but problems getting cases accepted, problems getting decisions enforced.
Right.
This is totally endemic to the whole legal system.
Well, that's positive. At least it's not just focused on environmental issues.
No. It's not personal.
It's not personal. I mean, the other thing in reading your book is that it was like, you know, I think like a lot of people outside of China, because there's been so much press about China passing so many laws of environmental protection, that in the Western press there is this talk about an environmental movement in China. You see protests. So you think, like, oh, this is a hotbed of activity. Like, stuff is really happening here.
Yeah.
And then I read your book, and I'm like, oh, wait, no, not really. Like, no, not really.
Yeah.
You know, and I think, like, you know, you're not really, like, seeing that. But when I did read your book, I mean, one of the, and I know you've mentioned the Environmental Protection Bureaus before, but one of the, actually, the hopeful things I did read in it is that there were parts where you talked about the success of administrative litigation in China. I guess, what's been happening with administrative litigation in China in the environmental sphere, and can you just describe more what that looks like
vis-a-vis
civil litigation?
Sure. So the most hopeful thing that I found was not in the civil, not so much in terms of civil litigation, but it was, I think, give a shout out to Zhang Xuehua, whose research this really draws on. Mm-hmm. What she found was that there's this part of the environmental litigation law that's not that well known, and which is that they're called non-litigation administrative execution cases. I always have to look at my notes because I never get that quite right. But that's what they're called. And what it means, to put it in English, is under the administrative litigation law, government agencies can bring lawsuits in court when their administrative decisions are not being followed.
Okay.
So what she found in Hubei province was that sometimes the Environmental Protection Bureau brings these lawsuits in court to sue polluters who are not paying their fines, and to get the court's moral authority and help calling these polluters to task.
Okay.
And so you can get this kind of synergistic relationship and alliance that can emerge between the EPB and the courts.
Right.
So between two parts of the Chinese government that are traditionally perceived as very weak. They can kind of help each other out. Because the court doesn't have a lot of tools at its disposal. But two things they can do is they can initiate... they can detain managers of firms that are not paying up.
Okay.
And they can freeze bank accounts.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And plus they have some moral authority.
Right.
You put all of this together, sometimes the EPB bringing these lawsuits can scare polluters into thinking, wow, the courts have gotten involved, the judges have shown up, now I really have to pay.
Yeah.
And she's just describing this pattern, this alliance emerging in just a few places. But it's really optimistic that there is that possibility for cooperation between these bureaus, that they can get more done together than either one could ever get done on their own.
So you're seeing this in just a few places in China.
Yeah.
Has it, spread since it started happening, since she started investigating Hubei? I mean, do you think this is a model that will spread throughout China, or...?
I don't know. I hope so.
They need something.
There's been quite a few of these non-litigation administrative execution cases in some of the environmental courts, in Wuxi in particular, and in Chongqing.
Okay.
In those two places, this type of case makes up a large percentage of what the court's dealing with.
Yeah.
And it there is provided a real way for the court to get enough cases to justify its existence.
Right.
So I'm optimistic that this may be a path forward for the environmental courts in particular. Mm-hmm. That it kind of works out well for both sides.
Yeah.
The EPB brings cases, and that's a way for the environmental court to expand its caseload and reach a more stable footing.
Right. And just in terms of the EPB, the Environmental Protection Bureaus on the local level, and then your book does talk about how, even though they still are underfunded and understaffed, I mean, it does talk about the huge increase in the number of staff that they've had over the past decade, and that in 2008, the National Environmental Protection Administration was raised to a ministry level, which gives it more power. Is this changing the culture of people who work there? I mean, what are the type of people that work there? I mean, I know in the United States you meet a lot of people who work at EPA.
Yeah.
And, and they're very into the environment, right?
Yeah.
And then they often go to NRDC and they'll go to Sierra Club. I mean, is that the culture that you're starting to see created in the government agencies that supervise environmental? Or is there still a lot of people where it's just a job?
I think, there's the visible upgrade in status for the Environmental Protection Bureau employees over the last 10 years has been positive.
Right.
There's more of a feeling of pride in your work, in their work, as you would expect, as the work has more visible importance placed on it. I think there's a ways to go before everyone who works for the EPB is a dedicated environmentalist. In the interviews I've done with EPB officials, the discourse is usually less about it is about protecting the environment, but it's mostly about finding a more appropriate balance. This balance idea is used a lot. Finding a balance between economic growth and environmental protection, and recalibrating that balance so that it's more appropriate for the current moment in China. And I think that makes sense. for right. where China is right now and for the kind of rhetoric that's coming out of the central government. But it does strike me that there is a big gap between finding a balancing point
yeah.
between economic growth and environmental protection and being a fervent and committed
right.
environmentalist
right.
at all costs, mm-hmm. as we might see here,
yeah.
at least in parts of the EPA.
Right.